From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a look into the world of a brilliant but amoral weapons designer and manufacturer. Gerald Bull designed a cannon that could theoretically shoot a missile thousands of miles, maybe even into outer space. But when he started working with the Iraqi military on perfecting his super gun, he was assassinated. We'll talk with James Adams, author of a new book about Bull. Also today, what direction is the new Supreme Court heading in? Duke Law professor Walter Dellinger reviews the court's latest decisions and examines the opinions of the court's newest justice, Clarence Thomas. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new book, The Overworked American. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Democratic presidential candidates Bill Clinton, Paul Tsongas, and Jerry Brown campaigned in the Midwest today, along with Republican challenger Patrick Buchanan and Vice President Dan Quayle. Clinton and Tsongas were in Chicago. Tsongas acknowledged that he'll have to make a strong showing in Illinois or Michigan following Clinton's victories in the Super Tuesday primaries. Tsongas won only in his home state of Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and the Delaware caucuses. Former California Governor Jerry Brown largely ignored yesterday's results, pressing for the labor support that backed Iowa Senator Tom Harkin before his withdrawal from the race. President Bush expressed satisfaction with his 8 victories in yesterday's primaries, but Patrick Buchanan said it's not yet time to end his quest for the Republican nomination. British Prime Minister John Major called today for a general election on April 9th. The polls suggest he has only an even chance of hanging on to power. NPR's John Idstey reports from London.
This will be the first time Major goes before the voters since he replaced Margaret Thatcher in an internal party coup almost 16 months ago, and he faces an uphill struggle. The British economy has been wallowing in recession for 18 months. Unemployment stands at 9.2%, and last year a record number of homes were repossessed. Recently, Major's Conservative Party began trailing the opposition Labour Party in the opinion polls, and for the first time in 13 years, Labour seems to have a good chance of seizing power from the Conservatives. But despite the dismal state of the economy, Labour has failed to pull ahead convincingly, and the campaign seems destined to be one of the most exciting in recent memory. I'm John Idstey in London.
In Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, thousands of students have been demonstrating against President Slobodan Milosevic, whom they blame for 6 months of ethnic war against Croatia. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
The students began gathering last night in the central Tirasia Square. Loudspeakers alternately blare speeches and rock music, and the students said they will remain until their demands are met. They called for the resignation of Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic, new elections, and freedom of the press. City traffic was at a standstill today. Many taxi drivers came to bring sandwiches and solidarity to the demonstrators. They declared the square an autonomous spiritual state, a takeoff on the autonomous enclaves declared by Serbs inside Croatia. The 2-month ceasefire in the fighting and the arrival of the first UN peacekeepers has given new life to anti-government movements. And a Belgrade newspaper known as the regime's mouthpiece today called for widespread changes in the Milosevic cabinet, which could lead to a dialogue with the opposition. This is Sylvia Poggioli reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 3,208. This is NPR. Police in South Africa said today that 9 more people have been killed in fighting between black political factions around Johannesburg. The latest killings bring the death toll for the past 5 days to more than 45. A number of people were killed on crowded commuter trains and railroad stations. The fighting is between supporters of the African National Congress and the Zulu-based Inkatha Freedom Party. Political analysts say the unrest is caused by the power struggle and ethnic rivalry between the two groups. The ANC has accused South African security forces of aiding Inkatha in the fighting. A new speed record was set today by the winner of Alaska's 1,100-mile Iditarod Trail sled dog race. Robert Hawk of member station KSKA in Anchorage reports.
Martin Boozer, a 33-year-old musher from Big Lake, Alaska, has set a new standard. He crossed the Iditarod finish line in Nome early this morning, 10 days, 19 hours, and 17 minutes after leaving downtown Anchorage. He's the first musher to break the 11-day barrier in this longest of sled dog races. The prior record was set by four-time race champion Susan Butcher in just over 11 days in 1990. A colorful racer, the Swiss-born Boozer is known for singing to his dogs to keep them happy on the trail. Boozer took second place last year in the middle of a fierce blizzard, and he says someone will probably beat his record sooner or later. In addition to being the fastest ever, this year's race was one of the coldest on record, with temperatures down to 60 below zero on the trail. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Hawk in Anchorage.
Japan's trade balance with other nations was up in February, gaining for the 14th month in a row. The Japanese Finance Ministry reported that Japan exported about $10.25 billion more in goods than it imported. That was a new record and double the trade surplus for the same period a year ago. Japan imported about 10% less in February than it did the year before. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most brilliant weapons designers of our time was perhaps also one of the most amoral. Gerald Bull is best known as the inventor of the supergun, an artillery system with the potential of firing shells thousands of miles. When Bull was assassinated in 1990, he was creating superguns for Iraq. Bull was an independent weapons designer and manufacturer who was also brilliant at exploiting arms control loopholes. He helped build the arms industries of Iraq, China, Israel, Chile, and South Africa. My guest James Adams has written a new book about Bull called Bullseye. Adams is the former defense correspondent for the London Sunday Times and is now the paper's Washington correspondent. One of his previous books was about arms merchants. Adams joined us several times during the Gulf War to discuss military operations. He told me Gerald Bull got his start doing legitimate research for Canada and the United States, not in weapons specifically, but for the high-altitude research project, a venture called HARP.
Bull was obsessed from a very early age until his death with the idea of putting satellites into space or other vehicles into space through the barrel of a gun. Now, he believed that you could actually do this very cheaply. You could do it for a fraction of the cost that it was being spent on rockets, which at that time was the focus of certainly the U.S. effort. And he got funding from the Army, from the U.S. Army, who were concerned that the Air Force were hogging all the action in space, and some funding from the Canadian government, and proved that this system worked. He set up a testing ground in the Caribbean, and he proved that the system worked. He threw things very high into space using old naval guns supplied by the U.S. Navy. And it was quite a successful project, but he was a difficult guy, and he upset lots of people. Like some scientists, he couldn't bear fools, and he couldn't stand the bureaucrats, and you have to tolerate both if you're going to survive in the military environment, which is full of both. So the project went wrong in the end. It ran out of money, it ran out of support, and it was complicated because the Army were only allowed to spend money on things that went a certain amount into space, and the Air Force went, if it went above 50,000 feet, then that was the Air Force's responsibility. Well, Bull was too successful for his own good, and the Air Force lobbied against him, and the project was scrapped.
After Canada and the United States no longer wanted him to work for them, he basically went into business for himself, started designing weapons independently for countries. And some of the countries he designed weapons for were countries that the United States and Canada had weapons bans against.
That's true. It was a very strange process, really, because once the HARP project had bitten the dust, he had to find a way. By this time, he had bought and had legally established this extraordinary complex on the borders of Canada and the United States, where he actually had a factory and a testing ground that straddled the border. So he was able to say, if Canada had a different export law, he would be able to say, well, actually, this bit was made in Canada, and if it benefited by being in the U.S., he was able to say the same. And this was tolerated by both sides because it was a sort of convenience, although I've never heard of anything like it before or since. So once HARP had gone, he then had to look at other ways of keeping these projects and keeping his employees in funds. And what he'd been doing with HARP was testing explosives and testing propellants and testing the design of things that fly through the air. And that is, of course, all to do with shells, as well as in what he was trying to do, which was satellites. So he was able to parlay that expertise and put it back into more basic stuff, which was designing shells and designing the guns to fire them. Well, that was cutting-edge stuff at the time, and he came to the attention of a number of people, the Israelis being one, the Belgians being another, and most importantly, perhaps, the South Africans being the third. And at that time, as you say, there was a United Nations arms embargo against South Africa, but they needed to find the weapons that they wanted, and their eyes fell upon Jerry Bull.
Well, in 1980, Bull served a six-month sentence in the United States for smuggling arms to South Africa. What were the charges exactly?
Well, after a very long investigation, the U.S. Customs decided that Bull had sent abroad shells, radar detection vans, some radar systems, and gun barrels, as well as the designs for the equipment. He wasn't charged with all those offenses. There was a plea bargain arrangement, and the charges were reduced. He was very surprised to be convicted at all. In fact, he, to the day he died, he was fighting to get a presidential pardon because he believed that all along he had been acting on behalf of the United States government and that he had full permission to export all of the things that were exported. And he felt that he had been very unfairly treated. And there was a lot of merit to that, actually. There was no question that officials in the U.S. government and in U.S. intelligence knew about what was going on. Whether they actively encouraged it or merely stood on the sidelines is difficult to say. But it was right that he should have got the impression that there was official recognition of what was going on. But again, I don't think he really understood the politics of the situation and became a victim.
Do you think American intelligence was being hypocritical?
I think it was expedient for, at the time, for elements of the U.S. government, as has happened so often in the past and in more recent times, to allow an individual arms dealer to supply urgently needed equipment to South Africa, a country that the United States was supporting as a bastion against communist infiltration from both Mozambique and Angola. So there was a confluence, if you like, or a utility of interests where both sides, Bull wanted to make money and sell his weapons. The United States government wanted to see the South African government get the weapons that it wanted. So I think everybody, so often in these things, it's kind of, well, give him a hand sort of thing, rather than it being written down in policy. And there is no doubt the CIA was involved how much is difficult to say. There's no doubt that senior government officials knew what was going on. But again, whether it was actual policy or people just saying, well, this seems like a pretty good idea, let's worry about the legalities of it later, is much more difficult to say. But Bull was the fall guy, and he paid a high price.
So after his imprisonment, he went into self-exile in Belgium and started working out of there.
That's right. I think he clearly, it's clear from his writings and from what he said to his family and so on, it's clear that he became very disenchanted. He had left Canada, the country of his birth. He'd gone to the United States, the country of adoption. He'd been made a U.S. citizen. He was, by a special act of Congress, he was very, as he saw it, loyal to the United States, and they'd turned round and stuck him in jail for something that he thought was an officially approved project. So he felt that he had no life left in the U.S., that it was all over. And while he was in jail, he'd received a letter from the Chinese government that said, "Dear Dr. Bull, we hear you're having a spot of bother at the moment. Don't worry. We think you're marvelous. We value people of your talent. Come and see us." And he got out of jail, and they paid for him to go to Beijing. and he got a wonderful reception. They greeted him warmly, both he and his wife. They sent him around the country. He was lauded wherever he went. And he decided that these were the kinds of people that he could do business with. And so he up sticks and set up shop in Brussels.
Most countries have some kind of restrictions or regulations on arms trade. Are there any international regulations governing an individual like Gerald Bull, who has the know-how to design arms and manufacture them?
No. And if you think about it, it would be very difficult to have any, because in Bull's case, you have a guy with a U.S. passport. He's living in Brussels. He flies to Beijing. Well, why are you going to Beijing, Mr. Bull? Well, I'm just going to walk along the Great Wall of China, actually. And how can anybody prove otherwise? So it's extremely difficult to control somebody's mind and their knowledge. It's very relatively easy to control product, but not the individual. And nobody has attempted to do that, in part because, of course, it's such a rare issue. You don't confront this very often, and that's why Bull, in an extraordinary way, was so successful, proliferating arms wherever he stopped. And you go around the country today and you look at all those arms manufacturers, third world arms manufacturers that are doing reasonably good business, and you look at Chile, South Africa, Israel, China, Yugoslavia, there, and Austria. There are all those countries, a Jerry Bull, and that's a pretty good effort, really.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Adams, author of a new book called Bullseye, The Assassination and Life of Supergun Inventor Gerald Bull. Adams is a former defense correspondent for the London Sunday Times, now their Washington bureau chief. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. James Adams is my guest, and we're talking about his new book about arms designer and manufacturer Gerald Bull, who was assassinated a couple of years ago. We saw the results of some of Gerald Bull's work in the Gulf War. How did he get involved with Saddam Hussein?
Well, the Iraqis were very keen on, as we all know now, on developing an indigenous arms industry. And Bull was approached by the Iraqi government and offered two things. One, they wanted him to design new and better artillery systems. And two, and more importantly for Bull, they said, well, we know all about this project you did years ago called HAARP, which involved trying to send satellites into space. Well, we're really keen on that also. And we have the money, you have the knowledge, let's get together and you can realize your dream with us. Well, this was a very seductive offer, and Bull took it up. His designs were also bought by the Iraqis from the Yugoslavs and the Austrians, and he, in his own way, significantly helped Saddam Hussein's conventional military capability. And he also designed and built for them these enormous superguns, which we now know about.
Well, the supergun was really one of his ultimate goals—a gun that could fire what, 1,000 miles?
Mm. Yeah, or further. I mean, it was there was no real limit. He would say that actually you could use a supergun outside of Baghdad to fire at the United States, because really you're sending it out into space. So what the shell on the gun is an intercontinental ballistic missile, but you're firing it from a gun and it's not a rocket. But the shells themselves were rocket-assisted, so you were really only limited by the imagination. If one accepted that the guns could actually work in the way that he said, and if they were designed as guns. Now, his family would say that actually they were really designed as satellite launches, and they weren't supposed to be guns at all. There were papers found on his body that there is no doubt they talked about, written in his own hand, talking about improving the lethality of the system. So he saw them as a lethal weapon, not as some kind of peaceful research that the benign Saddam Hussein was pursuing for reasons of his own.
Bull was assassinated before the supergun was actually created, before the ultimate supergun was created. How do you think it would have changed warfare and would have changed the balance of power if he had lived to finish it?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer, because we don't know still, and nobody knows, actually, how Saddam Hussein intended to use these weapons. Because if you can imagine this enormous gun with a barrel several hundred feet long, firing several Volkswagens hundreds of miles, well, what exactly would he use that for? The noise and the signature of the weapon would be picked up by satellites immediately. Aerial surveillance would detect it. You could only fire one of these things every few hours because they're so difficult to load and fire. So you wouldn't get many shots off. There'd be no opportunity for ranging shots as with a normal artillery system. So you'd have to be looking at firing a nuclear weapon or a chemical device, where you'd be looking at very blanket coverage. And you'd probably only get one shot. You might get two, you might get three, but you wouldn't get that many. So the threat of it would have been substantial. For Israel, for example, it would have been very serious indeed. They would have been well within range. Most of Europe would have been comfortably within range. So for somebody like Saddam Hussein, who is ruthless enough to use anything that he has in his rucksack, it would have been very serious indeed. And we don't know how serious, because would he have put a nuclear device on in the weapon? Would he have just used chemical weapons? Would he have used biological weapons? We don't know. Assuming the worst, and it was a nuclear device, it would have significantly altered the balance of power, very significantly.
One of the things you investigated for your new book is who assassinated Gerald Bull and why did they do it. So what do you believe now?
Well, I believe that the Israelis did it, because they have a history of killing people that killing individuals who they think are integral to a weapons program of a nation that they consider a threat. So they've killed Egyptians, Iranians, others who, Iraqis indeed, who have posed, they believe, play a critical role in a particular weapons program, and their death sets back that program a long way. Now, Jerry Bull was critical to the supergun program. Without him, it ground to a halt. So the Israelis are the logical suspects. The family believe that the American CIA killed him, and others, other businessmen who did business with Jerry Bull, believe that the British Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6, killed him.
Do you think that we're going to be seeing more Gerald Bulls in the future, more independent arms designers like him?
Well, I think there's been an evolution in the arms business in recent years, in that you've seen a number of new countries, not necessarily new individuals, but new countries emerge as arms producers. We've seen recently in North Korea selling anything to anyone, China the same. Singapore is an arms producer now, Brazil, major arms producer, Chile, all these countries which 15 years ago weren't even in the frame. So you've got not necessarily the individual like Gerald Bull, but you've got the arms industries that Jerry Bull helped set up, and others as well, which means these countries, who perhaps don't have the same sort of standards as we might, are prepared to sell whatever they make to whoever's got the cash to pay. And that's the problem for the future, how to deal with those manufacturers.
So one of the things Gerald Bull did is help other countries create arms industries, not just give them weapons.
Absolutely. I mean, before Bull gave South Africa the G5 howitzer with his special ammunition, which now the South Africans have exported all over the world. The South African arms industry was insignificant. They're now in the top 10 arms exporters in the world. And Yugoslavia, the same thing. Spain, similarly. Chile, the same thing, and so on. So where you have somebody who gives a country an innovative product, they can use that as the lever to develop a more broadly based industry. And that was the significance of Bull, that he was really very clever at what he did, and he gave these fledgling arms exporters a significant leg up in the marketplace, which gave them a place at the table and an opportunity to earn foreign exchange.
In investigating Gerald Bull and his work, what did you find out about his personality? What kind of guy was he?
He was a funny, warm, loyal, innocent, I would think. He, in so many ways, was the archetypal brilliant scientist, incredibly impatient with fools, very witty, drank a lot, exceptionally loyal to the people who worked for him, continued to pay their salaries out of his own pocket when the company was bankrupt, loved being with his family, very strong family loyalties, brought his children up in a very good way, and all his family are sensible, intelligent, sober people, if you like. So the sort of guy that you could actually warm to.
How are you innocent and amoral at the same time?
Well, I think, you see, they often can go hand in hand, because if you don't actually, when you go and sell a gun, and if you go along and you say, look, this gun is absolutely fantastic. It fires this wonderful silver bullet that works in this way, and your obsession is not with the fact that somebody's brains are going to be on the floor as the result of what this gun does, but with the performance of the product. He wasn't interested in killing people. In fact, he was actually rather opposed to that sort of thing, believe it or not. And he believed he was working for peace, not war, because people often convince themselves of that kind of thing when they're in that business. But
he kind of believed in deterrence. Good weapons help deter war.
Yes, he did. And he had no interest really in the end game. He wanted to be loved. He wanted people to admire him for his brilliance. So if the South Africans came up to him and said, Jerry Bull, you are the most brilliant man in the world today, sell us a gun, he'd say, absolutely, I know I'm brilliant. Thank you very much for reminding me of that. And so he was very innocent in that way and very amoral at the same time, because the morality of should I sell this weapon to this person or this weapon to that person never really entered into it. I mean, for example, he was very anti-communist, very opposed to communism, and yet there he was in China, because he convinced himself that the Chinese weren't really communist. They were sort of okay because they liked him. Therefore, they had to be okay. Well, he was just sort of stupid, really. He didn't understand how the world works. He just wanted to make great weapons, and he did.
James Adams, his new book is Bullseye, The Assassination and Life of Supergun Inventor Gerald Bull. Adams is Washington Bureau Chief of the London Sunday Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Everyone has been wondering how Clarence Thomas will change the direction of the Supreme Court. Coming up, we examine what the court's latest decisions reveal. We'll talk with Duke University law professor Walter Dellinger. And if you're feeling overworked and overextended, you may be interested in the new book, The Overworked American, by economist Juliet Schur. Critic Maureen Carrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The battle for presidential delegates has now moved to the Midwest, with candidates looking for votes in the two states with primaries next Tuesday, Illinois and Michigan. While Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton hopes to get a boost from his Super Tuesday sweep of southern states, former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas hopes to beat Clinton in neutral territory to keep his campaign alive. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The focus is now on Illinois and Michigan, and the Democratic candidates are looking for the labor vote to help. 295 delegates are at stake between the two states. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton has a well-organized campaign in both states with the help of Chicago Mayor Daley and Michigan Governor James Blanchard. He hopes his wins in the southern states give him the same push in the Midwest that his landslide victory in Georgia gave him in the South. Former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas, however, downplayed Clinton's southern victories today, saying the contests were primarily on Clinton's home turf. Tsongas is trying to paint Clinton as a machine politician with too much special interest money and too many inside connections. But if Tsongas had the same, he wouldn't be complaining. The economy should dominate the debate in the Midwest, with unemployment at 8.5% in Illinois and 9% in Michigan. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
In London, British Prime Minister John Major has called for general elections April 9th. A vote comes as Britain continues to struggle with a recession and a 9.2% unemployment rate. Giving up any hope of economic recovery before the Conservatives' five-year term ends in July, Major went to Buckingham Palace to ask the Queen to dissolve Parliament. On the average, over the last 2 weeks, Conservatives and Labour have been about even in opinion polls and are trailed by Liberal Democrats. President Bush today repeated his threat to veto any measure proposed by congressional Democrats that would result in a tax increase. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush left no room for compromise on the Democrats' economic proposals.
I'm going to veto this tax bill, yeah.
The president again said his decision to raise taxes as part of the 1990 budget agreement was a mistake. The only good thing that came out of that agreement were the caps on domestic spending, but now the Democrats want to remove those caps, the president said. Last week he seemed to imply that the only way to get the capital gains tax cut he wants is to accept a surtax on millionaires. Today he rejected that idea, too.
Because I don't want to raise taxes.
Not even on millionaires.
I don't want to raise taxes.
Later, the president told the Society of Association Executives he may take unilateral action to help spur economic recovery. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 22 points to close at 3,208.63 on volume of some 186 million shares. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia, thousands of students called for the Serbian government to step down today on the first anniversary of an anti-government protest in which two people were killed. Protesters called for new elections and amnesty for those dodging the draft for the war against Croatia. Meanwhile, officials say a van carrying observers from the European Community was fired upon, and three Croatian soldiers have been killed in fighting. It's believed that up to 10,000 people on both sides have died since war broke out more than 8 months ago. In New York City, Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz was confronted by members of the UN Security Council who charged that Iraq has not obeyed all UN resolutions on disarmament and human rights. Christopher Gunness of the BBC reports.
The American ambassador, Thomas Pickering, alleged that Baghdad was conducting a deliberate campaign to eliminate 4,000 Kurdish villages. He claimed there was a program of forced relocation, which he said gave credence to UN estimates that over 180,000 Kurds had disappeared. On the continuing attempts by the UN to eliminate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, he accused Baghdad of continued defiance. And Ambassador Pickering called for the immediate destruction of the Al-Atir nuclear plant, one of the few military facilities which was only partially damaged during the Gulf War. The British ambassador, Sir David Hannay, pointed out to Tariq Aziz that his government had miscalculated a year ago by believing that force would not be used to expel its troops from Kuwait, and he warned that Iraq should not again miscalculate.
Christopher Gunness of the BBC. A drop in the value of the U.S. dollar helped attract overseas visitors to the U.S. last year. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says that U.S. travel revenue climbed 9% last year, while tourism was just up 2% elsewhere. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The controversy over the Clarence Thomas nomination turned many Americans into Supreme Court watchers. The court is more than midway through its current term, although some of the most controversial decisions are yet to come. Recent decisions offer insights into the judicial philosophy of Clarence Thomas and the new court. My guest Walter Dellinger is teaching a course on the current term of the Supreme Court. He's a professor of law at Duke University. On this day after Super Tuesday, Dellinger reminds us that the president we elect might shape the Supreme Court of the future.
Well, it's quite possible, Terry, that the next president of the United States in the next term, the next four-year term of a president, could name a majority of the Supreme Court, that is, five justices. Nothing is certain, but a number of people who watch the court carefully believe that the five possible retirements in the next 4 years would be Justices Blackmun and White, who are both in their 80s, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who is probably likely to retire in the next 4 years, and possibly Justices Stevens and Sandra O'Connor, each of whom has had some difficulties with cancer that they have successfully surmounted, but nonetheless have given folks reason to wonder whether they may step down, so that we could possibly see a radically transformed court. As one of my friends jokes, we may see Chief Justice Hillary Clinton, depending on the outcome of the election. And if President Bush is reelected, I assume the court would continue to be filled with reasonably conservative justices. So we have these radically different futures for the Supreme Court, in some sense, depending on the outcome of the election.
Well, we've all been wondering what Clarence Thomas would be like on the Supreme Court, and we're getting some indication from his recent his recent decisions. He's been writing a lot of opinions, often dissenting ones. Is he being very outspoken for a new justice?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, Justice David Souter, who joined the court a year ago, was very quiet for his first term, both from the bench and in opinions. He wrote almost no dissenting opinions of his own and very few opinions of the court. Justice Clarence Thomas, in contrast, has hit the ground running on the Supreme Court and has, I think, surprised many of those who follow the court at how outspoken and aggressive he's been. And it's been a very short time. He did not participate in the cases that were argued to the court in October before he joined it, so that he's had relatively few occasions so far. But he has used those occasions to set himself out in a fairly dramatic way. Even on the earliest indications, he appears to have established himself as the most conservative member of what is already a very conservative court.
What gives him that standing?
Well, I think he has joined with the person who used to be the court's most conservative member, Justice Scalia, in dissenting from opinions by other conservatives. I mean, dissenting from the right. For example, last week, the Supreme Court decided a case involving a cruel and unusual punishment of a prisoner, Hudson versus McMillan. In the Hudson case, the inmate had an argument with one of the custodial guards, and two officers handcuffed and shackled the inmate. And according to the evidence the inmate presented, he was punched in the mouth, eyes, chest, and stomach while handcuffed and shackled, and kicked and punched from behind, while the supervisor told the two guards, quote, not to have too much fun, unquote. He suffered bruises, swelling, cracked dental plate. He sued and got $800 from a federal magistrate on the grounds that this was cruel and unusual punishment, and the Supreme Court agreed. That is, all of the Supreme Court but Justices Thomas and Scalia. Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion for the court and said that the excessive and unreasonable, unnecessary, and wanton infliction of pain gives rise to the possibility of a suit for damages. This was a relatively small $800 case, and Justice Thomas could have quietly joined in it. It didn't establish any great new law, but he wrote a very strong dissenting opinion, arguing that there should be no right of a prisoner to sue for a physical beating unless there was, quote, significant injury, unquote, the kind of injury that would require treatment in the prison hospital. Justice Thomas was joined in that dissent only by Justice Scalia, but it was a very outspoken step for a new and most junior member of the court.
I think everybody's been wondering how Thomas's background as an African American would affect his opinions on the Supreme Court. And one example we can look to for some clues about that is a case about a man who was sentenced to death in 1986 and appealed, saying that his rights were violated when his membership in a white supremacist prison group was used to persuade the jurors to sentence him to death. And Thomas was the lone dissenter in this case. He said that that should have been relevant, that it should have been allowed to be introduced, that he belonged to this white supremacist group. Can you explain the significance of this case and what you think that tells us, if anything, about Thomas as an African American?
Well, I think that the decision in that case, which is Dawson against Delaware, decided just this week, tells us more about Justice Thomas's attitudes towards capital punishment and his willingness to defer to prosecutorial interest than it does about any racial views. In this case, the prosecution introduces as one of the aggravating factors that the jury should take into account Dawson's membership in the Aryan Brotherhood, a white supremacist organization in the prison. And with that evidence before it, the jury came in with a sentence of execution. Dawson appealed, and the Supreme Court agreed that it was error to introduce the evidence of his membership. All other eight members of the court believed that it had First Amendment implications when the state would use someone's mere membership in an organization that had white supremacist views in this case. It was error to and stress the First Amendment, at least to introduce that as a factor in whether the individual should be executed. Justice Thomas was the lone dissenter. Again, it is surprising when a brand new junior justice will be the lone dissenter. He thought that the jury ought to know that the defendant had been and was a member of a racist organization. I think one should not draw any racial conclusions from that. It is as likely in future cases that death row inmates will be members of black militant organizations in prison as it is that they will be members of white supremacist organizations. I mean, this is going to be a two-way street. Justice Thomas's opinion would let in both kinds of evidence. The other eight justices consider this irrelevant.
We're talking about the current term of the Supreme Court. My guest is Duke University law professor Walter Dellinger. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Duke University law professor Walter Dellinger is my guest. Were you very surprised by any of the recent decisions that were handed down?
Not dramatically surprised. I think it was the one case that was a little bit surprising was to see that this court is now sufficiently conservative that it's more conservative than the Department of Justice in a Republican administration in some areas. I think this term represented the very first time in which the Justice Department's position in a voting rights case was rejected by the Supreme Court. The Bush administration argued that the Voting Rights Act was violated when a town, once its county commission had been had gained both white and black members, when they took power away from the newly elected black commissioners. The Justice Department said this should be considered as falling within the Voting Rights Act and remediable under that act. And a majority of the Supreme Court said no, the Voting Rights Act only applies when you cast your vote and doesn't apply thereafter. So I think it is pretty eye-opening how, in that sense, how conservative the court has become.
A lot of people have been concerned about how activist a Supreme Court we will have and how activist they will be in overturning liberal decisions of the past. That leads me to wonder how the Supreme Court decides which decisions it's going to hear.
In many ways...
Which cases it's going to hear.
Yes, no, right. In many cases, many instances, the most important thing the Supreme Court decides is what to decide. Every year, about 3,500 cases are brought to the court's attention by applications to have the court hear and review a case. And of those more than 3,000 cases, the Supreme Court will usually select about 150 cases to hear. So that's a very important part of the process. Deciding which cases to hear. Sometimes, you know, it's easy to eliminate a lot of the cases that are genuinely insignificant, but it's a very difficult choice for the court, and the court can, in a sense, set its agenda. To give you an example, Terry, I mean, this year, the court has granted several cases that involve property rights. Has accepted cases that property owners have brought complaining about environmental regulations and complaining that certain environmental regulations violate the property owner's constitutional rights. So this is now a court that is sufficiently conservative that it is at least interested in looking at property rights under the Constitution. And that reflects a new direction in the court and one that the court can make because of its power to decide what cases it's going to hear.
Who decides who writes the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion?
Well, once a case has been, it's interesting, the court reaches a tentative conclusion in a case very quickly. After the briefs have been submitted and oral argument, half hour aside, has been heard by the court. They'll hear oral arguments giving each side their 30 minutes on a Monday through Thursday. And then on Friday, the court will meet in its own very, very private, very confidential conference. I mean, it's so private that the junior justice acts as the person that goes to the door and takes and receives messages. At its private conference, the court will tentatively vote on each of the cases in which it heard argument that week. Then the Chief Justice will assign the opinion of the court in each of the cases, assuming the Chief Justice is with the majority. If he's not, the most senior justice in the majority assigns the opinion. Then the opinion writer will have anywhere from 3 weeks to sometimes 2 or 3 months to draft an opinion of the court and circulate it around to the rest of the members. It's all still private and behind the scenes. This process is going on now in some of these major cases. Once the majority opinion is circulated, the justices who dissent from it sort of informally caucus among themselves as to who will draft a dissenting opinion. Again, at this stage, there's no final judgment, and sometimes, the draft dissenting opinion does such a good job of showing the weaknesses in the majority opinion that a majority of the court shifts, likes the dissenting opinion better, finds it more persuasive, and changes the result in the case. That happens, I would estimate, since we don't know publicly, 2 or 3 times a term that the dissenting opinion wins the battle for the hearts and minds of the 9 members of the court.
Walter Dellinger is a law professor at Duke University. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, are you analyzing the results of yesterday's Super Tuesday?
Yeah, we'll hear from Elizabeth Arnold about where the campaigns are headed next after Super Tuesday, and also a talk with two political scientists and brothers, Earl and Merle Black, about the South and how Southerners vote in presidential races and in congressional races very differently is the answer, and we'll see which way turns out to be more common in the coming years. We'll also be talking with filmmaker George Lucas about his television series, The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, and we will learn about the origins of the Eskimo pie. Its creator has died this week. You know what it was originally called?
What?
The Ice Cream Bar.
Oh, please. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For many Americans, trying to balance work time with play time is a losing battle. A new book titled The Overworked American by Juliet B. Shore explores why and how the work side of the scale has gotten so loaded down. Maureen Corrigan has this review.
Juliet B. Shore tells us something in The Overworked American that deep in our weary minds and muscles we already knew. We Americans are working much too hard. Shore claims that hers is the first study to recognize that our work hours have been rising over the past 20 years. The dizzying numbers she crunches are guaranteed to make you feel justified in turning into a couch potato on your rare hours off. Shore says that each year, over the past 20 years, American workers, blue, white, and pink collar, have spent about 9 more hours on the job. When you add the hours up, the total increase is startling. On the average, we're working an extra month more than we did in the early 1970s. Americans today have fewer vacation and sick days. We're working more overtime and sometimes second jobs. Our manufacturing employees currently work 320 more hours a year than their counterparts in France and Germany, who, by the way, receive 5 to 6 weeks of paid vacation. Ah, but what about those industrious Japanese we keep hearing about? They do work more hours than we do. But Shore points out that excessive hours are considered a serious problem in Japan. Thousands of white-collar workers have keeled over at their desks and become victims of karoshi, or death by overwork. If we want to compete with Japan, Shore says, we should boost our productivity, and she demonstrates that shorter work hours often make for more productive workers. Shore is an economics professor at Harvard, and she backs up her arguments with plenty of stats, charts, and footnotes. But The Overworked American is not a chore to read. Shore is a graceful writer, and her facts about work are so incredible that even though her book is short, I filled up half a legal pad with notes, dotted with exclamation points, as I was reading it. Among the many myths Shore debunks is the image we have of people in earlier civilizations living lives of unremitting toil. On the contrary, Shore says steady employment for 52 weeks a year is an odd modern invention. According to one estimate, 13th century peasants put in only about 150 days a year working on the land. The rest of the time they spent drinking grog and waiting for the Renaissance to arrive. Another related myth is that capitalism created leisure time. Really, Shore says, it ushered in an expanded workday. And the consumer longings that capitalism generates have locked Americans into a cycle of working and spending in which leisure is left out of the loop altogether. Shore writes that the nation needs to slow down, unwind, and recover from its ordeal of labor. Sounds great to me, but how do we do it? Shore suggests implementing standard hours for salaried jobs, comp time instead of overtime, and part-time jobs with prorated fringe benefits. The only suggestion of hers that doesn't sound feasible to me is her Zen advice that we renounce our materialistic desires. Much as we might envy the long weekends those serfs enjoyed, I don't think Americans would willingly adopt a medieval lifestyle, sans TVs, VCRs, and microwaves. But as Shore points out, when it comes to enjoying our birthright to leisure time, Americans are still in the dark ages.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Nate Zelnick. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist David Wise tells us how the search for Soviet moles in the CIA crippled our country's counterintelligence operations for more than 20 years and destroyed the careers of several innocent men. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.